It's the Kim Munson Show, analyzing the most important stories.
That seems to me like government is establishing a religion.
The latest in politics and world affairs.
If you give people rights, women's rights, gay rights, whatever, there can't be equal rights if there's special rights.
Today's current opinions and ideas.
Surveys show that people still really prefer freedom versus force.
Is it freedom or is it force? Let's have a conversation.
Indeed, let's have a conversation. Welcome to the Kim Munson Show. I am Kim Munson. Be sure and check out our website. That's Kim Munson, MUNSON.com. Sign up for our weekly newsletter there. You will get first look at all of our upcoming guests, as well as our most recent podcasts and op-eds. Go over to Facebook and give us a like. We would appreciate that as well. And you can email me at kim@kimmunson.com. Also, thank you to each of you listeners. Really appreciate you. Today, strive for excellence. Take care of your heart, your soul, your mind, and your body. And I always like to say thank you to this great team that I get to work with as well. And that is producer Steve, Zach, Patty, Keith, and Charlie, and all these people over here at Crawford Broadcasting. It is Tuesday. We are halfway through November, producer Steve.
Yeah. And although, who was it said, maybe it's some idiot at CNN said, maybe there won't be Christmas this year. So, okay.
Well,
he gave us so much to look forward to. Yeah, it is halfway through November.
There was no Halloween, and now I think that Governor Polis wants to shut down Thanksgiving.
Yes.
He says that, what was it he said here?
On Friday, he made the asinine
comment.
This guy just...
You're in a mood today, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. But something along the lines that you needed to pre-plan your Thanksgiving by quarantining. Otherwise, you were effectively taking a loaded gun to point at Grandma's head on Thanksgiving Day.
Can you honestly believe that a governor is putting those kinds of scare tactics into people's, just trying to scare them to death, really?
It's a layered effort. I mean, I still had the Colorado will be out of hospital beds by the end of the year floating through my head. So it's a layered.
We'll see. You know what? We'll really see. We will know at the end of the year whether or not they were just trying to scare us or if there was some real truth in that.
Well, there's the real thing. What's the motivation here?
Mm-hmm.
And I think I know, and you and I discussed it earlier, but I don't know. Is it ready for prime time yet, our theory?
Let's wait.
Let's wait
on that one.
Okay.
We'll wait on that. But you also mentioned they're layering this. Steve, a real leader, actually, instead of trying to scare people to death, talks about solutions and tries to calm people's fears. Governor Jared Polis is the opposite of a Winston Churchill. When Britain was being bombed regularly by the Nazis, Churchill assured people. He had strength. He instead of scaring them, he gave them strength and gave them hope. This is just a complete opposite of what leadership really should be, Steve.
I can't debate you there. I mean, you want to look at both ends of a spectrum. You know, a spectrum is a layer or a band of possibilities, the good versus the bad or the have versus the have not. That's an excellent comparison there.
Thank you. I just thought that up myself just right now. Hey, we've got a great show planned for you today. This show is brought to you by my good friend and patriot, and that is Helen Jean Mitchell, and really appreciate her partnership on that. And then we'll be talking with Chris Cantwell with Transworld Business Advisors here in the first segment. Dr. Dana Chang, who is one of the co-founders of the Epic Times. Sorry about that. Will join us in the second segment, and she'll talk about why the Epic Times has not called the presidential race yet. And then in the third and fourth segment, Randall O'Toole, he is a transportation, housing, urban planning expert, and we'll be talking about the affordable housing industrial complex. So you won't want to miss that either. We look at these issues as freedom versus force, force versus freedom. Ultimately, socialism comes down to force. This morning, Steve, I saw a tweet by Ben Shapiro over at the Daily Wire, and it is a quote from Kamala Harris that she said, "Every day, Joe Biden and I will be thinking of you and your families." And Shapiro says, "That's what I'm afraid of." And our quote for today is from Aesop. It says, "Don't count your chickens until they're hatched." And Aesop was a Greek fabulist and storyteller credited with a number of fables now collectively known as Aesop's Fables. Although his existence remains unclear, and no writings by him survive. Numerous tales credited to him were gathered across the centuries and in many languages in a storytelling tradition that continues to this day. He was born in 620 BC. He died in 564 BC. And again, his quote is, "Don't count your chickens until they're hatched." And before we get over to Chris Cantwell here in just a moment, I wanted to just hit a couple more headlines that Patty had pulled. And the first one is that Xcel Energy has a $102 million plan to boost electric vehicle use, and it gets a hearing by the state. And this was last Thursday, and they're proposing this money, and the Public Utilities Commission will consider the plan by Xcel to invest in charging stations, incentivize homeowners to install charging equipment, and provide support for converting government and business fleets to electric. The utility has said the plan would support Governor Jared Polis' goal of having about 940,000 electric cars in Colorado by 2030. The move to more electric vehicles is seen as essential to meeting state and local goals of reducing greenhouse gas emissions and addressing climate change. It's critically important that we tackle the transportation sector because it's the number one source of greenhouse gas emissions. It's a huge source of asthma-inducing smog pollution and the brown cloud, said Danny Katz, director of the Colorado Public Interest Research Group and the Koperg Foundation. My friends, I want you to understand big business and big government like each other. And look at how they are working together to force people out of a vehicle of choice into something that they're going to choose. And then also putting something, and Xcel likes this because this creates more and more customers for their product, electricity. Well, on this, and at the same time, the Colorado oil and gas industry is arguing for economically reasonable greenhouse gas policies. This is from Colorado Politics. And Colorado oil and gas industry believes that the Polis administration's plan to reduce greenhouse gas emissions should allow flexibility in achieving targets, apply broadly to all sectors, and be economically reasonable. And so what we're seeing here is government is using policy to shut down one industry, which is reliable, it's affordable, it's efficient, and it's responsible, to push us over to another energy source, which is not reliable. It's going to get more expensive. It does require the mining of rare earth minerals, and all because of policy. So you see, big government is trying to shut down one energy source while pushing us over to another one, and that is not what government is supposed to be doing. The free market is supposed to make that happen.
Can I offer just one little phrase that we're very familiar with, just three little words?
Sure.
When Xcel is in the mix here, conflict of interest.
Most definitely.
And it is really galling. I mean, just they're hiding behind Polis' declaration of what, 900,000?
940,000.
Yeah, okay. And they're getting on the bandwagon saying, look at the revenues. You have people plugging their cars in at home. Where does that electricity come from? Who's
Xcel?
Who's selling it?
There you go. Big business, big government like each other.
And what was the other little nuance? Oh, the consumer buying equipment to install in their home to be able to do this. Well, who's going to pay for that? Well, the consumer. Yeah, okay. And
all the other consumers.
Yes.
For that consumer.
So this one stinks. It really smells bad. And I'll put that disclaimer out there. We, you and I, are not anti-electric cars. When the technology is mature and usable or user-friendly, let's say.
When it can compete in the free market without all of these incentives and force. And somebody that really appreciates free markets and entrepreneurship is Chris Cantwell with Trans World Business Advisors. Chris, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Kim. How are you doing today?
I am good. And entrepreneurship is something that is near and dear to your heart, Chris Cantwell.
It is. And what I want to talk about today is innovation and, you know, what makes a great entrepreneur someone who can innovate. And I know there's a lot of people out there that think, man, I'd love to be a small business owner, but I don't know how to innovate. So let me tell a story today, Kim. I met a client last week, and this client and his partner have a large concessions-related business, and they do events, stock show, conventions, big event, and obviously their business was brought to a screaming halt last year in March, or at the beginning of this year. It's already been a long year. Back in mid-March, right? Their business was brought to a halt. So they had to get creative, and they said, what are we going to do? This could go on for months and months and months, and this is our livelihood. And they said, well, what else do we know? And they said, well, you know, we're always working with all these counties. Hey, we know sanitation really well. What if we start some sort of a sanitation business related to all the COVID and cleaning and things that we need to do? And they jumped all over it, and they already had a bunch of the equipment. They had the tools they needed. They had vehicles. They had everything kind of in place for them to be innovative here and create a new concept, strictly adhering to what was going on in the marketplace with the pandemic. So they founded this business. Now they're in large centers. They went to home builders first and said, hey, we need to be able to clean your home so that you can show them, and big companies like that. And they've been growing this business like it's been growing like a weed. So they're at a point now where they're starting to look in the next year saying, hey, we got to get back to the real business that we have. And that's our concessions business, but we built this. We can't run both these businesses. We got to spin one of them off, and they're going to spin off the sanitation business. And they're thinking about taking it to market, and I'll help them go find the perfect buyer. So the perfect buyer might not be that innovator like they are, but it's someone that can take that business, that innovation, and grow it. Maybe take it to the next level, maybe some marketing, maybe just find ways to expand it. They'll still want to be creative. They'll still, as any business owner does, is want to be able to invent and be innovative on the main structures and ideas that their company was founded on. So here's going to be a great opportunity. Great innovators came up with this idea and this concept in the time of a crisis. They built it. They got it started. Somebody else is going to be able to pick this up and regrow it and take it to the next level. And that's what small business and entrepreneurship is all about.
I love it, Chris Cantwell. Now, is this one of the businesses that you have in your portfolio for sale?
I've met with the seller. We're not officially on the market yet, but it looks like I could be bringing this to the market very soon.
Creativity, innovation, that is inherent in the American spirit. We have been going through some really tough times, but during those times, as you just mentioned, there's creativity and innovation. Chris Cantwell, how can people reach you if they're interested in buying or selling their business?
They can call me directly at my number, 844 Sell Biz, B-I-Z, 844-SELL-BIZ, or find all of my contact information on the KimMunson.com website.
You got it. And Chris Cantwell, I so appreciate you. You are one of my valued partners.
Thank you, Kim. Have a great day.
Most definitely. You as well. And before we go to break, another one of my great partners is Hooters Restaurants. They have 5 locations right here in the metro area. Those locations are Loveland, Aurora, Lone Tree, Westminster, and Colorado Springs. And they have all kinds of specials. My friends, it is... with all that is going on, it's nice to just sit down with a friend and have lunch, or if you want to have people over to your house, they have to-go specials, game day specials. More information, go to HootersColorado.com. That's HootersColorado.com. We'll be right back. This show is brought to you by my good friend and patriot, Helen Jean Mitchell, and we will be right back with Dr. Dana Chang.
Karen Levine has over 30 years in the real estate industry. The reaction to the COVID-19 Wuhan virus is presenting unprecedented and unpredictable opportunities and challenges in buying or selling your home. That is why you need to work with award-winning realtor Karen Levine. Karen Levine comes highly recommended by Kim Munson. Call award-winning realtor Karen Levine today at 303-877-7516. Karen's expertise will help guide you through this crazy real estate market. Call Karen Levine at 303-877-7516 today.
You'd like to get in touch with one of Kim Munson's sponsors, but you can't recall their phone number. Find a full list of advertising partners on Kim's website, KimMunson.com. That's Kim, MONSON.com.
Welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. I am Kim Munson. Be sure and check out our website. That is Kim Munson, MONSON.com. Sign up for our weekly newsletter there as well. And you can email me at Kim@KimMunson.com. Also, in just a moment, we'll be talking with Dr. Dana Chang. She is a senior editor who is also one of the founders of the Epic Times. And she'll be talking about a couple of things. First of all, the Epoch Times has not called the 2020 presidential election. Most of the media, as you have seen, has. And then hopefully we'll also have time to talk about the significance to the timing of Hong Kong's communist China-backed government expelling four opposition members last Wednesday on November 11th in the complex aftermath of the United States election. So we'll be talking with her in just a moment. Before we do that, though, this was a piece that Patty had found. This is from the Epoch Times. And it says Dominion, which is this voting system that everyone is so concerned about, switching votes, that Dominion has been part of the council that disputed election integrity concerns in a DHS statement. It said, after allegations emerged that called into question the integrity of voting machines produced by Dominion Voting Systems, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, and that's CISA, I guess, part of the Department of Homeland Security, issued a statement on November 12th disputing the allegations, saying the November 3rd election was the most secure in American history. What the agency failed to disclose, however, is that Dominion Voting Systems is a member of CISA's Election Infrastructure Sector Coordinating Council, one of two entities that authored the statement put out by CISA. Does that also not seem like conflict of interest? A screenshot taken on November 16th of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency website shows the members of the Sector Coordinating Council. And in addition, Smartmatic, which is a separate voting machine company that has been the subject of additional concerns, is also a member. Does this not seem, my friends, like you've got the fox in the hen house? And with all of the information that is coming out regarding the possibility of these different voting systems, switching votes, I think that is of great concern. And then to find out that they are actually on the council that is watching over this, it smells very, very fishy. And so I know that the jury is still out on what is happening exactly with that. A couple of other things I wanted to mention here, and this is from The Federalist, and that is that the U.S. economy's remarkable recovery continues as Biden plans to crush it. Good news about the economy continued to pour in during election week. Predictably, the nation's establishment press, obsessed with the self-appointed insistence that Joe Biden is the nation's president-elect, virtually ignored it. On November 6th, so this was after the election, the government's October jobs report revealed that the nation's unemployment rate dropped a full point to a seasonally adjusted 6.9%, while non-farm payroll employment increased by 638,000 jobs. The reported unemployment rate smashed expectations that it would only drop to 7.6%, while the employment increase beat expectations by 58,000. The report's detail was even stronger than its headline numbers. I think that is really important. Those things were coming out just as we were coming through the election. My friends, as we look at the great news that is being squashed by the mainstream media, but yet they continue to trumpet that Joe Biden is president-elect, even while we have all of this, these challenges coming through, is something that we need to start to understand that we are at a precipice, Producer Steve.
That was a little play on words there, trumpet.
I know.
Yep, that was good, yes. Well, okay, I'm looking at something else that came off of another website, news website, about what's going on in Nevada. One county, I guess, totally blew up. And I should know the name of that county. I'm sorry, I don't. But the whole point is the communications director for the Nevada State Democratic Party tweeted out that Trump and his supporters on social media are working to spin what's going on in that particular county. Well, thankfully, someone else came to our rescue. The former acting director of national intelligence responded to that tweet and said that, you know, the Nevada Democratic Party is in full panic mode right now for what's going down in that state. And I know, you know, the Trump administration is basically grabbed onto that story and saying, here's further proof that something is just not right.
And, you know, the thing is now, I think we're in a bit of a chess match again. And that is, first of all, I don't think that this big deep state Democrat voting fraud thing, as actually Joe Biden actually said that they had established the largest voter fraud organization out there. Steve, I know you've got that soundbite. Can you put your fingers on that quickly? Put it into the conversation with Dr. Jill in the podcast that we did last week. And I don't think that they thought that they were going to get caught. I think there is some real arrogance in this. Now, the Trump administration, from what I can gather, is not alleging voter fraud. They're alleging voter irregularities, which I think is something that would be much easier to prove. And we're on a time frame, though, because the new president will be sworn in January. And so we are in a time frame, although remember that the media was calling Al Gore president for 30 days before that election was actually decided. Do you have that soundbite now, Steve? Okay, let's go ahead and listen to that.
Secondly, we're in a situation where we have put together, and you guys did it for our administration, the President Obama's administration, before this. We have put together, I think, the most extensive and inclusive voter fraud organization in the history of American politics.
Now, there's something wrong with that on so many different levels. The fact that he said it here and now, but also put it back on the Obama administration, the time of that era of reign of terror. I don't know which way to say it. But you see, this voter election fraud.
He said it's extensive and it's inclusive.
Yes.
And so a couple of things to really drill down on these numbers. And when I was doing the podcast with Stephen Peck last week, and you might want to go over to KimMunson.com and check that out. And that is that President Obama, and I looked at this, he received less votes in 2012 than he did in 2008. And people say anywhere from 3.5 million. I actually saw that it was one of the sites that I checked, it was more than that. So he received less votes in 2012 than in 2008. However, Donald Trump increased his number of votes by 8 to 9 million from 2016 to 2020. And the inclusive and extensive network of voter fraud that Joe Biden was talking about, I don't think anticipated that it would be that much. This is what I think happened, that they were using the Dominion voting machines and the software patches to that to actually change those votes. And it was someone up in Michigan, an election official, who saw this patch that came in on either the day before election or on election day. And these patches are done to software to update them. But she thought that was odd that would happen, because that system had already been certified. So think about it. This patch comes in on the day of election or the day before and changes all of these votes. And Joe Biden's extensive and inclusive voter fraud organization thought that would do the trick. But then when they realized that was not the case, when they were counting votes in these key states on election night, that's when they said, we're going to stop voting, patted everybody on the head, all the Republican watchers, and said, go home, we're going to get some rest, and we'll come back and start counting tomorrow. And that's when all of these ballots then came in that had been hastily, many of them hastily, voted on, and they were supposed to segregate those in Pennsylvania. I'm not sure that they did. And if they didn't, it seems to me that would invalidate those areas where that occurred, because they did not follow a Supreme Court ruling on that. And I think that's what I think that happened, because Donald Trump received 8 to 9 million more votes than he did in 2016, and Joe Biden allegedly received even more votes than that, which would be so far above what Obama got in 2016, it defies reason. And then you look at the down tickets, the fact that Republicans won more seats in Congress, state legislatures, it just doesn't pass the smell test. Jason McBride, what do you think about that?
Well, I think on your last bit with the down ticket doing so much better, you know, it takes time when you're trying to stuff a whole bunch of extra ballots in to go through and mark a whole bunch of little circles. If you're just really trying to get someone in for president and you've got these ballots laying there as an emergency backup, it's easier just to mark one circle.
You know, Jason, that is so interesting that you brought that up, because I was thinking, why aren't they recounting all of the other down ticket races as well? For example, in Georgia, I can't figure out why they're only, I think they're only recounting the presidential election instead of for those other Senate seats. But I guess that's what they decided. But I was like, that should, if they're doing a recount, that should change everything down ballot. But to your point, we're realizing that a lot of these, they only voted for one race, and that was the presidential race, Jason.
Yeah, well, now I don't know that for sure, but it would seem to explain why there was such a difference between the presidential race and the down ballots. And I think it would be something to look at as they're going through these ballots, if a whole bunch of them only have one circle marked, and that's for president. Of course, who knows what they've been doing with those ballots for the last week and a
right.
half, 2 weeks. They might have been going in and filling in all the circles they want. You know, really, every single one of them should have been locked up under lock and key and guarded like, you know, Fort Knox since then. But I highly doubt that that's been the case. And again, who knows what they've been doing with the ballots over the last couple of weeks to, you know, to cover up their tracks even further.
Jason, I know that you agree with me on this, or I'm pretty sure that you do, that if Republicans, if freedom-loving people were out there doing this, this, you know, what we're seeing happen regarding election integrity, that would not be okay with me. We need to have fair and just elections. And that would not be okay with me if my side was doing that, Jason.
No, well, I would be ashamed if our side was doing that. But we'd never be able to, Kim, because we don't have the media to cover up everything we do and to say nothing to see here, go, move along. And again, without the media to cover it and spin the story for them, they wouldn't be able to do the kind of stuff that they do. So,
Yeah,
that's fortunate and unfortunate that if Republicans attempted to do something in plain sight like this, there's no way they would have any chance of getting away with it because they'd be getting called out every day, 24/7, by dang near every media source out there.
Which is what the media is supposed to be doing, Jason McBride.
Yeah.
One quick question. The market, did it close at a new high yesterday, or what happened exactly?
Yeah, yesterday was a very strong day. The Dow was up 470. It did close at a new high. It closed right at the high for the day. NASDAQ, let's take a look there. That was up about 100 as well. It didn't quite make it to a new high, but it still looks strong. We had good volume across the board yesterday on the up move, which is a nice positive. Now, this morning, though, the futures are down about 250. I'm not seeing any specific blame being assigned to that in the news or by the experts, so it may just be a little bit of profit taken. We'll see how the rest of the day plays out.
Well, one strategy of a good offense is also to have some good defense. And with the market at these highs, I think it makes sense to sit down and with you, Jason, and your friends or your colleagues over at Presidential Wealth Management and talk about possibly moving some of these things into a more defensive position. This is a great opportunity to do that. Recommend that people do this before the end of the year. And people can reach you, Jason, at 303-694-1600, 303-694-1600. Recommend people do that, Jason.
Well, it's never a bad idea, like you say, Kim, to have some defense on the field. If you would have said back in the middle of March when the markets were plumbing, you know, basically the depths of Hades, you'd have said that the market would almost be doubled as far as the NASDAQ goes anyway, less than a year later with this virus supposedly still in full blast. I don't think most people would have believed that would be the case.
That's for sure. So reach out to Jason at 303-694-1600, 303-694-1600. Jason, we'll talk to you tomorrow.
Have a great show, Kim.
Thanks so much, and we'll be right back with Randall O'Toole regarding affordable housing.
Metropolitan Total Property is more than landscaping. Locally owned and operated since 1987, their team is proud to be your neighbor and live in the community. Metropolitan Total Property stands behind their work, and your complete satisfaction is their top priority. Kim Munson highly recommends Metropolitan Total Property for landscaping and more. She was one of their very first clients way back in 1987. Be sure to check out MetropolitanTotalProperty.com for their complete menu of services. Again, that's MetropolitanTotalProperty.com.
Recently, rates in the mortgage market have hit near record lows. Lorne Levy with Polygon Financial notes that the COVID-19 Wuhan virus disruption has created potential opportunities to refinance your mortgage that could save you thousands of dollars. And for those senior listeners who may be looking for another source of income, exploring a reverse mortgage with Lorne Levy may be a solution. With over 17 years in the mortgage industry, Lorne Levy has the experience to answer your questions. Call Lorne Levy at 303-880-8881. That's 303-880-8881 for a mortgage checkup today.
Welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. Be sure and check out our website. That's Kim Munson, MUNSON.com. This show is brought to you by my friend and patriot, Helen Jean Mitchell. I greatly appreciate that. On the line with me is Randall O'Toole, and he is a land use and transportation policy analyst, and he's author of American Nightmare: How Government Undermines the Dream of Home Ownership. And he is at the Antiplanner. And he has written a piece, super informative, regarding the affordable housing scam. Randall O'Toole, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
This is quite the piece that you have written. And when I was on city council from 2012 to 2016, I inherently kind of knew some of this, but I hadn't really put it into words. What you have identified here, Randall O'Toole, is so important. And where do you want to start with this exactly, Randall?
Well, I think it's important to make the distinction between affordable housing and housing affordability. Housing affordability refers to the affordability of housing to everyone, you know, rich, poor, middle class, whatever. Affordable housing is subsidized housing that is built for low-income people. And, you know, even when housing is very affordable for everyone, for almost everyone, in places like Houston and Dallas and so on, there might be a few people who are so poor that they can't afford housing at all, and so we might want to subsidize housing for them. So we have these affordable housing programs that are designed to help provide housing for people who just can't afford it on their own. Unfortunately, these programs, which cost taxpayers tens of billions of dollars a year, have been turned into a big scam. And they aren't really providing affordable housing, and they aren't helping that many low-income people. They're just helping developers and others to cover up their sins as regards to government policies that make housing less affordable.
Randall, when I was on city council, I saw, and what we're realizing is big government and big business and big nonprofits, they like each other because they can use policy to pick winners and losers, if you will. And I actually went over, there was an affordable housing project that was being built. And the more I delved into it, it was almost like government was holding these home builders hostage. They said that we will approve this project over here if you will build affordable housing over here. And I thought that, there was something inherently wrong about that, Randall O'Toole.
Well, that's a policy called inclusionary zoning, and it says that developers are required to provide some low-income housing whenever they build any housing, and it ends up making all housing more expensive because the developers have to make up for their losses by charging more for the new homes they build at market rates. But there's another program called Low-Income Housing Tax Credits. It was created in 1986 to be an alternative to public housing, which we knew had been a big failure. They'd built a whole bunch of high-rise public housing projects that mostly were uninhabitable, and they mostly have been blown up since then. So they got the idea, well, let's have the private sector build affordable housing. They're so much better at it than the public sector. They're so much better at building anything that we'll let them do it, and we'll give them tax credits. You know, the federal government will just reduce their taxes when they do it. And so they give out $10 billion in low-income housing tax credits a year. If you're a developer, you can build low-income housing, and you get to turn in these tax credits. And you don't have to pay taxes you would otherwise have to pay. If you don't have any taxes, you can sell the tax credits to someone else who does have taxes, and that way pay for up to 70% of your low-income housing. Well, how do you get the other 30%? Well, it turns out there's a whole bunch of other low-income housing funds as well. So what we end up getting is housing projects built by developers who put up zero money. 100% of the money comes from different kinds of low-income housing funds, and then they are required to rent out perhaps 10% of the apartments in the project to people who live below the poverty line, and they rent them out at very low rates to those people who live below the poverty line. But the other 90%. They can rent out to anyone who has a median income that's less than the median income of the region. So, for example, the median family income in the Denver urban area is $103,000. And so they can rent out apartments for $2,500 a month to people who have a median income of less than $103,000, and they call that low-income housing. So 90% of the units don't really help people below the poverty line. Only about 10% do. And the rest of them end up going to people who are really middle class. Now, that's just the beginning of the scam. The developers haven't put up any money of their own, so they're charging near market rate rents to people, and it's pure profit. They do get to pay, some basic costs of maintenance and things like that, but they don't have to pay any of the construction costs. And since they don't have to, they don't care how much it costs. Housing agencies have bought into the high-density planning dogma and promote mid-rise transit-oriented developments. So you see all these five-story apartment buildings that have sprung up all over Denver. A lot of them are built with affordable housing funds. I've counted 364 projects built in the Denver area with low-income housing tax credits, and the vast majority of them are big projects with more than 50 units of housing. Many of them have hundreds of units of housing. And the cost per square foot on these mid-rise developments can be two or three times as much as the cost per square foot of single-family homes. And all those low-income housing tax credits can be used to build single-family homes, and I've seen them build a few in other parts of the country. Not a single one has ever been built in the Denver area. There was one duplex built once, but the vast majority of them are big projects with dozens, scores, hundreds of units of apartments in each project. And since they're mid-rise, which are more costly, documents show that the people who are distributing the low-income housing tax credits, they don't care about the cost. So they're more concerned about promoting transit and compact development and all the other latest planning fads than with cost-effectively using the housing funds. Typically, it costs right now under $150 a square foot to build a single-family home. Many of these units are costing $500 a square foot or more. Some of them cost more than $700 a square foot. And they don't care, because their goal is to reshape society. They want people living in high-density housing projects. They want people riding transit instead of driving. So they build them on light rail lines. And because that's so expensive per square foot to keep the units affordable, the average size is very small. I've seen some that are 400 square feet. The average tends to be about 600 to 700 square feet. So about the third of the size of a new single-family home, which would have cost the same amount of money to build. They're spending $300,000 building a 700-square-foot apartment. For that $300,000, you could build a very nice single-family home. But that's not the current fad, so they don't. So using these limited funds, these limited taxpayer dollars, to build supposedly low-income housing for low-income people, and they're spending them wildly on ridiculously expensive projects that really aren't very livable at all.
And we continue to see these four- and five-story apartment buildings within the metro area. Rana O'Toole, let's go to break, because I'd like to get your perspective on what you think COVID has done to this social engineering policies to move people into these compact apartments and to try to get them to ride light rail. COVID has changed things significantly, and I'd like to hear what you have to say about that. This is Kim Munson. I'm talking with Rana O'Toole, and he is the author of the book American Nightmare: How Government Undermines the Dream of Home Ownership. Before we go to break, though, one of my other great partners is Castlegate Knife and Tool. Family-owned business located right here in Sedalia, Colorado. They're getting ready for Christmas. They have all kinds of inventory, so all kinds of great things for those on your guest list. Go to castlegate.com for more information. That's castlegate.com. We'll be right back.
Predovich & Company understands that the COVID-19 Wuhan virus disruption has individuals and businesses scratching their heads with a variety of bookkeeping, tax planning, and accounting questions. Predovich & Company knows that you need trusted professionals to help you navigate these choppy waters. Kim Munson highly recommends Predovich & Company. Because of their advanced technological capabilities, Predovich & Company can help clients anywhere in the United States. Call Predovich & Company at 303-791-3000 to organize your personal and business finances. Call 303-791-3000 today.
All of Kim's sponsors are an inclusive partnership with Kim and are not affiliated with or in partnership with KLZ or Crawford Broadcasting. If you would like to support the work of the Kim Munson Show and grow your business, contact Kim at her website, kimmunson.com. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com.
Welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. Be sure and check out our website. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com, and sign up for our weekly newsletter. This show today is brought to you by my friend and patriot, Helen Jean Mitchell. Thank you, Helen, so much. And on the line with me is Randall O'Toole. He is a land use and transportation policy analyst and author of American Nightmare: How Government Undermines the Dream of Home Ownership. Randall, these policies that you're talking about in this piece that you've done, the affordable housing scam, these policies have really been an assault on people owning their own homes. And owning your own home is something that's inherent about a vibrant middle class. It helps people create wealth. And yet we're seeing policies that are trying to put people into these cracker box apartments and make them ride transit just wherever they go. And people would prefer generally to have their own home, have freedom of mobility. If somebody wants to live in an apartment and ride transit, as long as that can compete in the free market, fine. But that doesn't seem to be the case. It seems to be that you have to have government coming in with these big nonprofits and this big business to pick winners and losers. COVID has really disrupted all of that. What's your thoughts on that, Randall O'Toole?
Well, COVID has certainly changed people's perceptions about the desirability of riding transit or living in big apartment buildings, but it hasn't changed the players at all. They still want to build light rail. They still want to build high-density transit-oriented developments. It hasn't changed their feelings at all, and they'll tell you statistics about how if everybody wears a mask, it doesn't matter whether you ride transit or not. You know, even though the data show that it does matter, they're just going to try to get people to do it anyway. And you've mentioned nonprofits a couple of times. About one out of six of these low-income housing projects in the Denver area have been built by nonprofits. And because they're built by groups with pleasant-sounding names like Mercy Housing, it creates an aura of respectability or an aura of altruism. But these nonprofits are just as interested in the bottom line as for-profit developers. Most of them have executive CEOs who get paid over $500,000 a year. They have a lot of vice presidents and other executives who get paid over $200,000 a year. They're just as reluctant to let apartments to people below the poverty line. You know, they'll do the minimum of letting out 10% to people below the poverty line, but a lot of these developments they build, they're mainly renting to the middle class. And so we have this system where we've drawn urban growth boundaries and things like that that have made housing expensive. Then to assuage our guilt for making housing expensive, we build this affordable housing that's only available to a handful of really low-income people. They built 38,000 units of low-income housing in 33 years in the Denver area. That's not anywhere near enough when you consider that 90% of those units probably are not even priced to be available to people below the poverty line. And yet none of the nonprofit groups that call themselves low-income housing advocates are saying, hey, we care about low-income people. Let's get rid of green belts. Let's get rid of urban growth boundaries. Instead, they're advocates for more subsidies to low-income housing. They're advocates to more subsidies to their empires. And they're just fine with urban growth boundaries because it means their clientele is going to be even larger, and it's going to create more of a demand for them to build more low-income housing with more subsidies. And they're just ignoring COVID. They're just ignoring what the effects of this are going to be. They're probably right now planning the next 100-unit apartment building. There's still pressure on RTD to build a rail line to Longmont, even though RTD's own numbers show that it's going to be the least used and most expensive rail line yet as a part of their RTD rail empire. And so nobody seems to have responded to the COVID to say, hey, maybe we better rethink these policies. Let's stop doing them at least until we find out how it changes how people behave.
Well, and if people, from a free market standpoint, if people want to live in a small apartment and travel on light rail, as long as that financially works in a free market, more power to them. But what we see, Randall O'Toole, is that the planners come in and say, as you mentioned, the planning, the policies make single family homes less affordable. We see here in Colorado where XL Energy is lobbying the PUC for more money so that they can push people into electric vehicles. And once again, if somebody wants to drive an electric vehicle, great. But that doesn't mean everybody else needs to subsidize that. And so if these things can compete in the free market, great. But these planners, and I'd like you to address that just a little bit, these city planners that come in and work for government and most times make six-figure salaries plus benefits, they graduate from all of these public universities or all these different universities that they have been indoctrinated into, this is what we envision for a community. Address that, please, Randall.
Well, I'm beginning to think that everybody in our schools is being indoctrinated now. You know, I see people who go to school, and in high school and in college, they become environmental studies majors, and they come out firmly believing that light rail is good, that high-density housing is good, and they may even live in that kind of housing for a brief period of time in their lives, and then smugly think that they're better than everyone else because they do. But when they get married and have children, then they start wanting to live in a single-family home. If they've got a $100,000 job, I'm sure they'll be able to afford one. And the fact that their own policies have made housing unaffordable to anybody with a $50,000 job or an $80,000 job, they don't care about that. They've got their house, and they still firmly believe that more people should live in high-density housing. And so nationwide, about 65% of Americans live in a single-family home, and only about 30% live in multifamily housing, and then there's a small percentage who live in things like boats and mobile homes and stuff like that. But we see places where they have set as targets that they want to reduce the percentage of people living in single-family homes to 40% or less and get more people packed into apartments. They do that by manipulating housing prices, and so we end up having 25% or more people who would aspire to live in a single-family home but are never going to be able to do it in their lifetimes because of these market-altering policies.
Randall, do you think that with the whole COVID-19 thing, people working from home, the destruction of many of our cities that are run by Democrat governors and Democrat states, do you think there'll be a resurgence of rural America? Because housing is very affordable in many of these smaller towns. Do you think that people will move there?
Well, people are already moving there. We're already seeing people leave the big cities and move into smaller towns and move into rural areas. So it's happening. The question is how permanent it will be. If we get a vaccine, are people going to move back? And there are some people who are saying they're never going to move back, but economists know that you can't rely on what people say they're going to do. You have to find out what they actually do. The Gallup poll that was taken shortly before the pandemic found that everybody wanted to live in a lower density area than they already lived in. And so 20% of the people who lived in big cities didn't want to live there, whereas 20% more people wanted to live in low-density suburbs than actually lived in such low-density suburbs, and 20% more people who wanted to live in rural areas than actually lived in rural areas. So people do want to move to smaller places. The question is it, will it be affordable for them? Will those smaller places have adopted policies that make them unaffordable? Will President Biden force places to become less affordable to meet some climate goal? And then will he compensate with that by throwing in some more low-income housing subsidies for a select few middle-class people? Those are the kinds of questions that we have to worry about. It's fine to say that people aren't going to want to, but if the government still makes it hard to do that, makes it hard for people to live in small towns or rural areas or suburbs, we might not see that trend happen.
Oh, my gosh. Randall O'Toole, how can people get this piece that you have written, The Affordable Housing Scam? I would highly recommend that people, it's about 5 pages long, and it explains this so well. How can people find this?
Well, it's posted on my anti-planner website, which is ti.org/anti-planner. And I forget, what's the number of that?
Let's see here. Number 72.
72, okay. Well, the whole address would be ti.org/anti-planner/pdfs/apb72.pdf. But If you just go to the Anti Planner, you'll be able to find it. Just go to Anti Planner and search for low-income housing scam.
Very, very informative. I so appreciate this explanation today, Randall O'Toole. Stay in touch, and we'll have you on very soon. Very soon. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. And my friends, our quote for today is again from Aesop. He said, "The level of our success is limited only by our imagination, and no act of kindness, however small, is ever wasted." So my friends today, be grateful, read great books, think good thoughts, listen to beautiful music, communicate and listen well, live honestly and authentically, strive for high ideals, and like Superman, stand for truth, justice, and the American way. This is Kim Munson signing off. God bless you, and God bless America.
Fast on a rough road, riding high through the mountains, climbing, twisting, turning, further.